Welcome to another edition of the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Jennifer Baumgardner is one committed, accomplished, and controversial woman with an impressive activist career. Last summer, the well-known journalist, author, writer, speaker, cultural critic, and filmmaker was named Publisher Executive Director of the Feminist Press at CUNY, the City University of New York. Coincidentally, Jennifer and the Feminist Press were born in the same year. Some background highlights. After graduating from Lawrence University in Wisconsin, Jennifer moved to New York City, where she worked at Ms. Magazine as an unpaid intern. 4 years later, in 1997, she had become the youngest editor at the magazine. A year later, she left and began writing for numerous publications. Jennifer's work explores abortion, sex, bisexuality, rape, single parenthood, women's power. And to that end, she's written 6 books. Her first, Manifesta, Young Women, Feminism, and the Future, co-authored with Amy Richard and published in 2000, became a best-selling classic about third-wave feminism. 2 years later, the pair founded Soapbox, Speakers Who Speak Out, a leading feminist speakers bureau. Jennifer, by the way, has been a keynote speaker at more than 250 colleges and universities. Her 2012 documentary, It Was Rape, raised consciousness about that issue at campuses all around the country. In 2008, she launched the outrageous, unorthodox T-shirt campaign, I Had an Abortion, to encourage women to come out about undergoing the procedure and show that having an abortion wasn't a shameful secret, but part of the lives of women we know and love. That was followed by the film Speak Out, I Had an Abortion, a book and a photo exhibit. There is so much ground to cover, but before we get started, just one more piece of information. Jennifer is from Fargo, North Dakota. I believe you're my first North Dakotan.
Wow. I get that a lot. People say, I've never met anyone from North Dakota. Kind of like that. No one's from North Dakota, right? But yeah.
Well, I did see Fargo by the Coen brothers.
A great movie.
I
was grateful for that movie when I first moved here because literally no one, it wasn't merely that they'd never met anyone from Fargo. They were like, I don't know what North Dakota is, basically. And Fargo, the movie, put Fargo on the map. I go to Europe and people say, oh, Fargo, you know, like it was such a wonderful movie. And it, you know, it gave a glimpse of the culture. It really did, of what it looks like and also the sound of the accent.
I want to hit the ground running. And I read that you were profoundly influenced by feminism at an early age.
I think it was just a coincidence of when I was born in a way. I don't want to take this away from my parents because obviously they contributed to it. But I was born in 1970 and the women's movement was really up and running. Mm-hmm. And so even though we were in North Dakota, my parents were deeply impacted by this. And so they were taking into account, you know, they were from this like rural, you know, sort of background in North Dakota, but they were thinking about things anew, the way I think all people were at that time, or particularly young people were. So they were thinking about the civil rights movement and they were shocked by the assassinations of, you know, JFK and Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then feminism too was, I think my mom for the first time thought, well, did I choose to be a teacher? I thought there were only 2 jobs, so did I really make an informed choice to be a teacher?
Nurse or teacher.
Exactly.
Right.
And then my father, you know, the same thing. I think he kind of marched through life assuming things were going to go a certain way and that he and my mom, they met when they were 12, they're still together, that their lives would go on a certain way. But the emergence of feminism tapped into questions my mom had probably always had about her own self-worth and who she should become. And some sadnesses, too, because I think so much of who you become in your life is sort of when you were born and mm-hmm. where you were born and mm-hmm. other things that happened to you. And so she was actively negotiating those things when I was a little kid. So Ms. Magazine was on the coffee table. I feel like I was, you know, I've always wanted to, you know, when I was little, I was always trying to be precocious and just wanted to be the one that knew everything. You know, it's like an issue for me. But because we had Ms. Magazine, and it wasn't so common actually in Fargo to have Ms. Magazine in on your coffee table, I knew what a lesbian was at a really young age. And
wow.
I knew what meant to be, I don't think they used the word transgender, but I remember I was seeing something about being cross-dressing. I had all this information that was pretty racy as a young kid. And my parents sort of entrusted me with it. And my father's a doctor. And we talked all the time about abortion rights and how crucial they were to women's empowerment. And now I look back and I realize we never ever acknowledged that we knew anyone who had an abortion. There was still this barrier, you know, of like abortion happens to other people, but we support it, you know,
right.
That I think we had never bridged until we were much, much older.
Would you think your parents were aberrational?
They were. They were aberrational. It's funny because they're pretty they're Democrats and they're very liberal and their politics continue to evolve. And I really, really respect them. But it's, you know, in New York, I don't think they'd be considered so radical. But in Fargo, among my peers, as parents, they, especially because they had this outward form of like really traditional looking family. The mm-hmm. dad is the breadwinner. The mom's a stay-at-home mom. There's three daughters. But internally,
behind closed doors.
Yeah, they were really, maybe because of all that stability and all of that acceptance that they got for everything else, they were able to be a lot more radical in terms of their personal politics.
So this was discussed around the dinner table.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then you took this background with you to college.
Absolutely.
Where I read that in the late 80s and early 90s, while you were at Lawrence University in Wisconsin, you organized guerrilla theater, a feminist group on campus. Why?
I wanted to be an actor. I was really serious about it, but I was also really political. And so I, with some other students who were protesters, created this radical theater piece, but it was, I mean, it's like not quite accurate to call it theater, but you would never do this now post 9/11. I'll just come right out and say I feel differently about it now.
Well,
but,
that's evolving.
I mean,
it was what
it was back then.
Yeah,
there hadn't been exactly this kind of domestic terrorism at the time, even though I knew about the Weather Underground. I guess I was probably influenced by that sort of, you know, glamorous idea. And we rented prop machine guns, but they looked very real. We rented fatigues. And we put, like, nylons over our faces, and we staged a siege of the Commons, which is where everybody ate dinner. So it was packed at the, like, time when most people would be there, the night before the Gulf War invasion was going to happen. And it was definitely not a success. Like, people were terrified. Everybody was screaming.
And were you ostracized?
Running. We felt righteous. Yes, we were. We felt righteous, though, because we felt like we knew why we were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
you were committed.
Yeah. And we there was damage of school property. We like knocked over the Sunday bar or something. And it all took like a minute. We were so adrenalized. It took like a minute. And then we escaped and went to the Human Rights House where they had said they would give us asylum. It was like this on-campus house. And the administration was really, I mean, the students were more outraged, I think, because maybe they felt patronized by us. And there were a lot of students who were from families where a lot of people are in the military.
Sure.
I am too, but I mean, I was taking this different view. And so there's a lot of really good critique that came out of it, I think. And it was good for me because I was a big fish in a small pond and I kind of learned how to deal with the pressure and the heat of being criticized for something you deeply believed in because you took a stand. And the administration was really supportive. I think they were a little eye rolling, but they, most of them were of the age where they were deeply influenced by the Vietnam War. And I think in a way felt reassured or was familiar to see that kind of activism, that it wasn't for my peers. And so it was a really interesting experience. It was one where I felt in a weird way that I was just kind of aping something I'd heard about as opposed to it being really, really genuine. And on the other hand, I learned so much about protest and taking a stand and the kinds of things I could possibly do.
So it emboldened you.
Absolutely.
How did you move from politics, although it's all in the same mix, obviously, to feminism? To issues of gender and sex and feminism.
Well, I think that had always been my lens. I remember, again, because of these early experiences,
being
three daughters, seeing my mom grapple with what it means to be a housewife.
But it's different now when you're in college, I think, somehow. You're not in familiar territory.
Yeah. Well, in college, I think the thing that made it so much about gender is that because of my age, I'm also when women and gender studies departments were really coming to every school.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this big move in the late 80s. So the first women and gender studies departments were in like 1968, 1970. And then there was like a little bit of a lull. A lot of places took them on and then there was a little bit of a lull. And in the height of the backlash, some other places like my college.
Was your college a forward-thinking university?
In a lot of ways it is, honestly, but it has some conservative elements too. It's no Oberlin, but, you know, we have a gay president and he's married. And I think in some ways we, in a quiet kind of Wisconsin way, show a lot of leadership and it's very progressive, but it wasn't a radical place in the least. And, I guess I just always felt this sense of awareness of gender as a way to orient my own activism, but maybe partly because, so I grew up in North Dakota. We had one abortion clinic and it was in Fargo. It wasn't far from where I lived. And it was just under siege in the 80s from the Lambs of Christ was the organization at the time. But, and that was another thing of feeling like your town is invaded by people you don't know. and who are radical, radical activists and who want to take away something that I had been raised in my family believing that this was a fundamental human right.
Were these radicals local people?
They came and were bused in. Yeah, I mean, they liaised with local people. Certainly mm-hmm. there are local radical pro-life activists in Fargo. But this was during those Summers of Mercy things that were going on in the late 80s.
Right.
So I was part of the people doing clinic defense. So that was when I was a teenager. So I think I had these opportunities, both through trauma and through opportunities for activism, to really start thinking of myself as a feminist activist.
It's almost as if this is what you were going to do. It was kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah, I feel like I was born a feminist, and I think my mom wouldn't disagree. And I think my sisters are the same way. Like, we've had to learn the language and learn the philosophy and learn through experience what our values are, but that feminist piece has been really essential to who we are.
But that also means that you've been fighting for a long time.
Yeah.
And doesn't that on some level, I mean, I know we're jumping around a little bit, but doesn't that exhaust you?
It depends. I get very depressed around the rape piece because there's been so little advancement that I see in terms of how often that happens.
Your film.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that?
Sure.
Okay.
It really grew out of the I Had an Abortion project that I did first. So the reason I used to write my beat was really abortion. Like, I wrote about rape, too, but and other things.
So let's start with that, because that came first. The abortion campaign came first. What's the genesis for that? To go so out there with a T-shirt that said, I had an abortion. That's really stunning.
I've always been attracted to outrageous things or things that are shocking, not just for shock value, but when they can penetrate. And that the sort of show business element of activism, too, that you really have to understand and appreciate that piece of it. Mm-hmm. And that's my acting background, I think, makes me respect that. And I had this friend who said she was dealing with the fact that she had had an abortion, and I was dealing with the fact that I had an STD sort of simultaneously. We were in our early 20s, and we were talking about the shame involved, and I was like, the worst part to me is the shame, like feeling like I had to be quiet and stigmatized about it.
Because you had a sexually transmitted disease?
Yes, so that was my situation, then hers was about an abortion.
Okay.
And she said, we should make T-shirts that where everybody has to have the thing that they're most afraid of other people knowing on their shirt. So, fast forward 10 years— I had been covering abortion rights and abortion activism for The Nation, Glamour magazine, Allure, Elle, Dissent, sort of like you name it, all these different venues.
That came after your tenure at Ms. So
right, after my tenure at Ms. Right, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And when I was writing full time. And I realized I was burnt out even on interviewing people on, quote, my side. I just felt like I was hearing the same thing over and over, and we weren't getting anywhere.
Move that needle.
Yeah, it was all just sort of like, oh, we're going to lose Roe v. Wade with the next, Supreme Court, but it kept not happening.
Right.
And so there was a way in which I was fatigued and irritated even by my allies, which isn't – I'm not saying that's fair. I think I was actually fatigued with my own approach.
Mm-hmm.
And thought again about this T-shirt and thought how – there was a big march that was coming up, the March for Women's Lives in 2004, and I had been to the one previous where women would wear shirts that say things like, George, get out of my bush, like really sort of vulgar things,
right,
you know?
Right,
and they're willing
that.
To wear that. But right. I thought, what's the most striking thing you could say? What is the scariest thing you could say? It would just be owning the fact that you did have an abortion and that there's millions of us, and I have had an abortion. And so I wanted to make that shirt that just simply said, I've had an abortion, nothing else. And it went through some iterations, and then Third Wave Foundation, which is this fabulous young feminist foundation, agreed to finance the original printing of these shirts. And I had them made in time for that event. Then that fall was the 2004 presidential election. And for the first time, Planned Parenthood was taking a stand. They had a PAC, and they were taking a stand. They were endorsing a Democratic candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And so Gloria Felt, who was the leader of Planned Parenthood at the time and was a friend and ally of mine, she had agreed just – kind of just being a good person, informally had agreed to sell the shirt on the Planned Parenthood site. And Drudge and all of these right-wing people attacked her. So it ended up overshadowing this, wonderful evening where she was kind of making this stand that Planned Parenthood was going to make a stand. She was totally dominated by the fact that Planned Parenthood provides abortions, and they used this T-shirt very much out of context in order to kind of minimize her.
Mm-hmm.
And so it became – but the flip side is it became this huge scandal that it wouldn't have. It had just been me, even though it had been getting attention. But being attached to this brand name of Planned Parenthood made it so – it was in every paper, and people were really debating it. And what was wonderful about that is I think it helped tease out all the ambivalence that people who are supportive of abortion rights have about abortion. What I've learned or what I feel like I've observed is a lot of people do feel like the stigma piece is essential. I do feel like it's about power. And it's the power to give life or not give life, which is actually an incredibly profound power. And I don't know that most people have really reconciled themselves to how much power that is. I don't think culturally we're supported as women in being comfortable with that power at all. But the Roe decision actually says to women, you have that power. And I think this is a little bit of generalization, but I think we've probably been a little comfortable with having some of that power taken away because it feels like a lot
normal.
Feels like a lot of responsibility.
Yes, yes.
I have the power to choose this baby to be born and not this one.
Yes, 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 yes.
And, you know, I have had an abortion and I feel like I
– And it's not a cavalier decision that you made, if I can interject that. It's not so simple. Then people seem to – you know, it's not like I'm going to have an abortion and that's the beginning and the end of it. I mean, there's a struggle for that.
I mean, it was pretty easy to make the decision in the moment, but which it often is for people. But, you know, over the years, I think about it differently depending on what's going on for me. You know, when I think about like, oh, I could have had another child. I mean, there's no poignance there for me. It's not like I don't think about that loss to my heart, as someone in the documentary put it. But I also think about the reasons that I chose to do it, and they were really valid. And they were very maternal because they did it in a lot of ways have to do with the kids that I have. But, you know, it's a mixed bag and it's a big decision. And I think that this, for me, the stigma and the inability to talk about the really important things that happen to us as human beings is a sign of how oppressed we are as women to this day, even though things are so great on many levels. The fact that we can't talk about some of the most significant things that happen in our life is a sign of how not free we are.
Although that's such an issue that's controversial in that sense about I have the right and the power to make that decision, I also have the right and the power not to talk about it.
Oh, absolutely. If you choose not to talk
about it. Right,
I think there's a cultural mandate not to talk about it. I mean, I think why it was so disturbing for people to see a woman in a T-shirt that said I had an abortion isn't just that that's a casual medium, but it was because we don't really want to see that. We don't want to think about that. It's a really hard thing to think about. And I think it can be. One of my closest friends is a woman named Merle Hoffman, who owns Choices Women's Medical Center. So this is a clinic that started pre-Roe. And so she's been providing abortions, like thousands and thousands and thousands, more than a million women.
Wow.
For 40-some years. And she's been really helpful for me in my evolving point of view around abortion rights, which is that I'm even stronger in my belief that it's critical for human rights, for women's human rights, and also that it's a really deep, complex decision and that there is loss. And I really try to like face myself. I think it's very personal, but face myself in terms of like, what do I really think an abortion is? I don't think in any way it's casual, but I think it's necessary. And I even think about things like having had the opportunity to go to a lot of abortion clinics and to have seen products of conception after a procedure has really helped me face what abortion is and deal with it in a way that seeing like protest signs and stuff just doesn't really help because it's just so.
But is there a part of you that says Roe v. Wade has been on the books for such a long time? Can we not just move on to something else?
Well,
women don't make the same money as men do for the same job. And I'm not diminishing abortion. Yeah. I'm just saying, come on.
Yeah, I think it dominates in a way that it's very tiresome.
Yes.
Because it's a guaranteed wedge issue and it dominates our understanding of what feminism is, too, in a way that I think is probably not healthy. But I think it's related to women not making the same amount of money. I think it's those ideas of empowerment, your ability to be a self that makes decisions for yourself and that yourself is so valuable that you could actually sacrifice a self within, you know? And I think that has to do with not getting the same amount of money and things like that on some deeper level.
So tell me, what provoked you for the It Was Rape project that you launched in 2008?
Well, I think I'm obsessed with things that are common, but we're not allowed to talk about. And after kind of thinking about abortion for a long time, the thing that came to mind, a lot of people brought up to me when they would share their abortion stories, honestly, was that they'd been raped. And I knew from personal experience how incredibly common that is and how still so, how silenced. And so I just started interviewing women and men about their experiences with rape. And every story, I mean, without trying at all, every story is totally heartbreaking and powerful and amazing and crazy making, you know, because of what happens after. In almost every case, what happened after the rape was harsher than the experience itself.
And did you interview any rapists?
No. People often ask that. This was really, the perspective was really just about staying. I think because of rape shield laws, et cetera, it's very easy to objectify and make a boogie person of typical rape victim. Mm-hmm. So these were women, they used their full names, and you just looked at them and you heard their story and you saw archival footage from their lives and you got a full person, and that was the point of it, was to have it be about them and not about the multiple perspectives around this incident. It was a very powerful experience, and one of the strongest stories, I mean, they were all amazing, but one really amazing story was this woman who found me at a college lecture. You know, every time I've ever said I was working on a project about rape, many people come up to me afterwards and share a story. And she said, I was incested by my dad for many years until I was like 12, but then, but I'm, you know, I'm okay because I talk about it and stuff like that. And so she was flying. She lived in Florida, but she was flying to New York for something. And so I interviewed her. And when she actually told the story, she never really said it. Like, she had acknowledged that it happened, but she never really talked about it. She was totally shocked by her reaction and about the things that came out of her mouth. Like, because it still was so scary and almost like it felt gross to her to say these things. Mm-hmm. There was so much shame, you know. And then a couple years later, when I was finishing up, she called me. And her life had changed so much since then. It was, I mean, I don't want to give away the movie. But it's like once you start letting that out, and divesting yourself of that, of the burden of carrying that story,
it sets you free.
So much can happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's still part of her story.
Of course,
but she's in a really different place.
This manifesto that you wrote mm-hmm. with Amy Richards in 2000 about, you know, young women feminism in the future. You're talking about third wave. In the 14 years since that book has been published, how do you feel about where we are, where mm-hmm. we've been? But start with the genesis for that
okay.
book.
Well, I think manifesto happened because. Well, Amy and I were friends, and we were both fortunate to be sort of fully immersed in second wave feminism, kind of really high level second wave feminism was how it felt. She worked for Gloria Steinem, and I worked at Ms. Magazine, and we had a lot of respect for the relationships we had built, and we were kind of like the young feminists that got invited to things, that got to be at the table. But we also were sort of junior, you know, and I think we were realizing that some of the feminism that we saw from our peers, there was a lot of hand-wringing, like, what's going on with your generation? Not you two. You guys are fine, clearly, because you're here. But, uh-huh. you know, everybody else, they're awful. And we felt like we had an opportunity to represent the feminism that we saw from our peers and how strong it was and how it was indeed an evolution of what it had come before. And so that was the reason to write the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really successful. So, I mean, I feel good about that because I think that it really needed to be written. And I think a lot of young women saw them and men saw themselves in that book. And it did help to change the conversation in women's studies departments and to invite people to call themselves a feminist, to say here's a different iteration of feminism that you might relate to a little bit more on a generational level. Here's our references,
which is
Just that, you know, we grew up with feminism in the water. Hmm. It didn't descend as it did for my mother when she was 25 and already mm-hmm. had two kids. You
mm-hmm.
know, I grew up with a lot of things already in place: abortion rights, Title IX, you know, access mm-hmm. to equal access to resources and education, language around rape and domestic abuse and all that sort of stuff, even if we didn't have everything we needed to change the reality. And that's just a really, you know, lots of women in higher office. You know, it's just a really different
right.
reality that I started with.
And women people, in business.
Yep. And women and men of my generation, that's what we started with. And so we're just trying to say, so if you're standing there and you're looking forward, do you see something different?
Or were you worried about complacency?
I wasn't, actually. I didn't
about
feel like
your,
I saw
not
that.
Not you personally, but about your generation.
No, I wasn't. I mean, that was one of the reasons to write the book, is that I felt like I saw young men and women screaming feminism from the rooftops. They didn't always call it and label it feminism, but they were living feminist lives. They were living lives that their parents maybe could barely have imagined.
I'm going to read from an article about the book that the authors use matter-of-fact language to address their next question. What exactly is feminism? Feminism is not only a movement for social, political, and economic equality among men and women, but also requires the freedom to access information and education. Race and ethnicity are key to the modern feminist movement.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you feel about the modern feminist movement?
Well, it's interesting. I actually feel that like that racial piece has an enormous conflict still. And it's not an easy conflict to mend because it's so historic and it's been going on for so, so, so long. And I think I've probably been guilty of trying to gloss over it because I always knew that Black women and women of color were so essential to feminism and
mm-hmm.
that had created the movement.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is resource allocation and even allocation of who gets interviewed and things like that and like who ends up representing feminism is still skewed incredibly white. So there's a big disconnect. And I perpetuated in passive ways by, you know, being a white person that represents feminism, you know, and continuing to do that. And I'm also trying to undermine my own privilege a little bit and try to understand it better, not be defensive about it. I had a conversation with some women who are really important thinkers who use social media as their main way of communication last week, and we were really it was me and one other white woman and then five kind of really prominent Black feminists. And I really felt the pain that's underneath the anger. And I think I'm barely scratching the surface, but I felt it, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that my own sort of like pain about feeling misunderstood can't come first or can't be on the same level. And one woman, she's a really great thinker, said, because she knows that I write and think about incest a lot, and she was like, you know, which I think is much more common than people are willing to admit, and it's like, so, like, you're definitely not allowed to talk about that. And she said, think of America as our father and think of black women as and white women as sisters, but the black women were incested. And they have a different experience of family and trauma and pain, and it affected the white sister too, but differently.
Differently.
So it's like we're carrying a lot of trauma and pain too, but it's different. It wasn't the same. And so like the impact was not the same. And the abuse was not the same. So she was really helpful in putting it into metaphors that I, you know, that relate to things I think about all the time. And I need to think about that more, because I do feel like there's been a lot of really interesting activism, like the Solidarity is for White Women hashtag. And, you know, people protesting Miley Cyrus and her kind of cultural co-optations. And even Ani DiFranco, who's like one of my favorite feminists ever. I just love her so much. And the fact that she was going to have the songwriting workshop on a plantation and sort of just the cluelessness associated with that, you know, and trying – having people who are pushing back and having then white people, white feminists really take it in, as opposed to figure out why – They didn't mean any harm, so their intentions were okay. And I'm
you mean
really,
it was inadvertent?
It was inadvertent. It was a moment of cluelessness. And I believe that – but these moments of cluelessness have to be connected to something larger and more systemic.
Sure, they're seminal.
Right. And trying to understand them more and you know, to make my politics actually more authentic, which is, you know, I say that I want this world that's more equitable, but I don't really just mean for women or for white women. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Even though that's
– you see that as your mission.
Yeah,
in a sense today.
Yes, but I think I'm in a way still at a point of like barely understanding how deep the divisions are.
So what do you want to do about that?
Where I'm starting, you know, with this group of women is the conversation. And what I feel like I'm hearing is the even building trust, well, that we're not even at that point really.
Mm-hmm.
And within feminism, and some of the trust building would come from if somebody really actively did do different resource allocations. So like if I had, let's say, an opportunity to do something that was going to be really raise my profile, and instead I said, you know what, I think this other person would be better for it, and really support, you know, when the person resists or whatever, go, no, we wanted you, you know, to really just stand strong about actually diverting resources to
And people. Do you feel that you've got the, and I use the term in quotes, power to do that through the feminist press?
I have to think about the platform that I do have from the feminist press. You know, what it is, what I know it is an institution of feminism. It is. It's a second wave institution. It was like the press that was created, you know, that came out of that movement when women were just taking the means of controlling everything. They were like, we're going to make our own record companies and we're going to do our own distribution networks. And this was the press. While it's not, you know, it, you know, of course, I experience the feminist organizations I work with as totally marginalized. It's not as marginalized as it could be, because it is. It's a mainstream white feminist organization. It isn't just for or populated by white feminists, but it has that kind of core.
So are you going to change it in any way, alter it in any way?
Alter the feminist press? You know, I think that we're going to have – Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a consciousness that we're trying to create in terms of our programming and our books that I think is already there to some degree, but it could be there more. And then I think in terms of – I mean, what I was hearing again at this meeting is, you know, when bad things happen to women, black women are there. And when bad things happen to black women, white feminists aren't
are
there.
Not there. What's your take on what's going to happen tomorrow? Are you optimistic? Aside from the ethnic and racial part of this, how do you feel?
Yeah, I feel really good about being a woman. And I feel really good about feminism, which I think feminism is for all people. And when I'm on college campuses, which I am a lot, a little less than I used to be, but still probably 15 campuses a year, people are excited by feminism. So while there's still a lot of, you know, just that typical like, can I be a feminist and shave my legs? You know, sort of like these small barriers.
Permission.
So, yeah. Permission granted. people are drawn to it. And it's men and women. And and transgendered people as well. And so I feel like that there's a lot happening around gender and feminism right now. You know, that's really obvious. But I think people are attracted to feminism because of its intersectionality too. So like their ability to put a feminist lens on any issue that they are drawn to. So it could be prison reform, or it could be like healthy food in your, you know, school system or whatever. I feel very excited about feminism, honestly. One thing that I'm personally really committed to and concerned with sometimes is that the feminist story to me is really a big one with lots of characters. And I think has a lot of, I mean, human rights are definitely at its core, but also this notion of power and being comfortable with power. And so I'm very interested in corporate women and what they deal with, as opposed to people who feel really alienated by the Sheryl Sandbergs of the world.
Oh, what do you mean by that?
I mean, I hear a lot of, you know, she's so privileged. How can we take anything she says seriously from, you know, from a feminist world, from a feminist viewpoint?
You mean silver spoonish, born with a silver spoon?
Not just that, but so it is true that the vast majority of women are not multi-millionaires the way she is.
Mm-hmm.
But she's unique in lots of ways in that, in terms of the responsibilities of, you know, commanding a big company like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, it's like women, I'm really interested in women who are grappling with power in meaningful ways. And I think corporate women are doing that in a way that is meaningful and often misunderstood, and that we're, I feel like now I'm speaking such generalizations, but I think historically feminism has been so suspicious for good reason, you know, of capitalism and things like that. But within capitalism, which is the reality in which we live, I think it's really important to understand the trials of the corporate woman, you know, and the power, the potential power there.
Or lack thereof.
Or lack thereof, exactly, wherever that may be, and how it's a very different, I don't consider somebody who, like, works for themselves to be more righteous, or somebody who's, like, a grassroots activist full-time to be more righteous, necessarily. They might be.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, everybody has these opportunities within whatever sphere they're in to be pretty powerful. And I guess that gets to, you know, within Manifesto, one of the things I think Amy and I really kind of tried to bring to the table of discussing feminism is, for our generation and younger, feminism is portable. It isn't something you do because you join now or because you go to this feminist bookstore and volunteer, but it's something you carry with you at all times, like contact lenses. It enables you to see the world differently.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And enables you to see the opportunities you have every single day to make change.
And I would think that you would be a real proponent of women in politics.
Oh, absolutely.
In terms of making change. It's one thing in the corporate boardroom, but
changing
the laws.
Well, no, I think it's similar. I think it's similar. Like, what person has to deal with compromise more and look more like a hypocrite more than a politician? And I think that when we see women in those jobs get more and more power, we're going to see more of that. But I think it's part of reality of, like, dealing with that level of power and that level of alliance building that happens as you reach higher and higher levels.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, they're very comparable.
You're a mom, and you have sons?
Mm-hmm. I have two sons. I have a 4-year-old named Agnes and a 9-year-old named Schooly.
And what have you taught them, even at 9 and 4?
Well, it's funny. I mean, so much of what being a kid is you learn from observation, not some what you see, not what you hear.
Mm-hmm.
Your parents telling you that you supposedly the family values are. They have been exposed to these words, abortion and rape and feminism, a lot already. I mean, not that those are the 3 words that go together, but I'm just saying these are words that maybe a lot of kids don't hear. And so I've had to already answer the question of, like, well, what is abortion? And why do you support it? It sounds like something you shouldn't support. Like, my 9-year-old said, from a kid's perspective, shouldn't I not be supporting it? And I was like, well, you don't have to support it yet or not support it.
Boy, I'd like to be invited to your house for dinner.
Exactly. You know, he asks me these really profound questions all the time. And
you answer them or dad answers them?
I answer them. And we talk about them a lot. And I'll say, I don't have a really adequate answer, but I think this is a conversation we can continue to have. The other day, Schooly said to me, who invented feminism? And it's just like, it's sort of like, who created God if God created the world or whatever? I feel like they ask these really profound questions.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I love best about it is they go to sort of conferences with me, or they'll go to a college campus with me, and they're just really used to being in feminist settings with, like, you know, rainbow flag buttons and just they have open minds, I would say. And some of that is New York City, too, which would thank God. But it's really the specific window, which is feminism, that I value so much. And it would be very painful if my kids, if that was just like something I did during the day and then I came home and my family was different.
Sure.
So the fact that they're somewhat integrated is great. And I love having boys. It's funny. I guess I don't know what it's like to have girls. My kids have different dads. And so it's actually, we have a complicated sort of modern family, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Complex modern family. And when I was before I married the person I married to, I was a single mom with schoolie, and I was really into it. It was actually a really wonderful experience. I mean, it was hard too, but it was a really wonderful experience in a lot of ways. And I had this sense of like what boys could be that was really shaped from that experience, I think, because I felt sort of like it was just the two of us against the world or whatever. Mm-hmm. But we also had a lot of community support and stuff. And one time I remember I was dragging the stroller. You know, he was really little. I was dragging the stroller down the stairs, you know, to get on the subway. And this kid, this teenage kid who looked kind of tough, started walking towards me with this kind of like cold, menacing look on his face. And I was like, ah. And he came and he just took the stroller from me and carried it down. And at the end, I was kind of like, oh, my God. I said, thank you. And he said, you're welcome. I was raised by a single mom, ma'am. And it was this moment where I was like, first of all, can you tell? I was like, but also I felt this profound connection of like, my son could maybe be someone who, because of the way he was raised, he'll notice when someone needs that assistance.
Right.
He has that sensitivity now. And it was really moving for me and has really stuck with me. And I do think school is really sensitive and likely would do something like that.
Well, we could go on and on and on. It was fascinating to talk to you, Jennifer.
Likewise.
You've got so many tales to tell. I hope that third wave feminism is alive, well, and kicking.
I think it really is, and I think that people continue to find ways to see themselves in the movement and to define feminism for themselves in meaningful ways, and you kind of need that. You can't be nagged into it. You have to come to it through personal experience, and I'm glad we both have.
And I will leave everybody with Ride the Wave.
Sure.
How's that?
Perfect.
Thank you so much. Join us for another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at the 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.